Turning now to the book of the prophet Daniel and chapter 1, the book of the prophet Daniel, chapter 1 and verse 1. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, came Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, unto Jerusalem and besieged it. And it is the year 605 BC, the first of Nebuchadnezzar's attacks on Jerusalem. He was to attack again, successfully each time, of course, in 597 BC, and then in 587-86, when Jerusalem fell and was entirely destroyed, and the temple and the captivity, the 70 years of captivity in Babylon began. But in the first attack, siege and attack, a number of people were taken away, particularly younger people, young men, and no doubt many others also. But we read of that in these opening verses in the book of Daniel. Now, our subject is simply Daniel, a premier prophet of the exile. And how similar is the life of Daniel in some striking ways to that of Joseph? And his role was similar also. Joseph, well, during the captivity of the children of Israel in Egypt, there was a man, Joseph, as you know, who, by the providence of God, was ultimately elevated into very high position in Pharaoh's administration and could do so much in that position. And so, with the Assyrian or the Babylonian captivity under Nebuchadnezzar and his successors, so there would be one who would hold high office on behalf of the children of Israel, and so much could be done for their maintenance and protection. Well, Israel, over 100 years before, had gone into captivity, the northern kingdom, now Judah, the southern kingdom of the divided kingdom of the Jewish people, now that was to fall. But from Judah, Judah was to be preserved, because from Judah would all the promises of God be fulfilled, and the Messiah would come, the descendant of Abraham, and in due time of David. And so there was no question that the captivity, and so Isaiah had prophesied, the captivity would come to an end and matters would be restored. And Daniel was one of those, as a young man, who believed that, and believed the prophet Isaiah, believed the other scriptures also that spoke of the release from captivity. But here it is in this first verse, the initial conquest of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon. He's called king of Babylon, but he wasn't actually king of Babylon until immediately after this conquest. He was a under-ruler of Babylon who was deputed to these military supervision of these military expeditions, and soon after this first conquest, he became king, emperor in his own right. Verse 2, and the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, and the great humiliation, with part of the vessels, the valuables of the house of God, which he carried away into the land of Shinar to the house of his God. And he brought the vessels into his own treasure house. And the king, the emperor, Nebuchadnezzar, had directed Ashpenaz, the master of his eunuchs, that certain royal princes, royal descendants, and sons of princes of Judah would be brought in, rounded up, tested, and the very best of them, those who had real abilities, would be brought to Babylon to be trained as Chaldeans, so that they thought like Chaldeans. They learned the Chaldean learning and language, of course. They would ultimately be rulers of their different provinces. That was the idea. But they would be people who would be young people of great ability who would be brainwashed to think and to understand and look at things exactly as Chaldeans would. That was the whole object and the intention. And Daniel was among them. for verse 4 and verse 5, you see the qualities they must have: no blemish, well-favoured in appearance, youths of good physique, and very able, skillful in all respects, in learning particularly, and people who obviously had in them somehow discerned the stature to hold high office on behalf of the Chaldeans and Nebuchadnezzar, to stand in the king's palace. And verse 5, the first great test of Daniel and the other Judean boys. The king appointed them a daily provision of the king's meat and of the wine, and they would be nourished and fed in these ways, in Chaldean ways. And then they are named, Daniel and the three friends, in verse 6. But there were very probably more Judean young people in this band. The way the narrative proceeds, it gives hints here and there that, and in this very chapter, that there were others also, and they were renamed. And their names that hinted at Jewish, Hebrew names were changed for those which reflected the names of the gods of the Chaldeans: Daniel, Belteshazzar, Hananiah, Shadrach, Mishael, Meshach. You see it in verse 7 there of chapter 1, and to Azariah, Abednego. And then the great 8th verse, because this is the first test. But Daniel purposed in his heart, he determined that he would not defile himself with the portion of the king's meat. No doubt there were some elements in that royal Chaldean fare that were offensive to a Jewish person. Possibly the meat had been offered to idols. We're not told that, but we may assume it, that there were moral reasons in Daniel's mind, as well as spiritual reasons, why he shouldn't sit and eat the king's bounty. Well, for one thing, it was rich food. He would be trained as a Chaldean, and he would be bribed as a young person, as it were, to desire the high life of the royal court of the Chaldeans. The whole thing was intended to subvert them and to entice them. So there were no doubt some very religious reasons why they would be offended at the fare they were offered, but there was also this strong identification, indulging in and participating in this rich royal fare of Nebuchadnezzar's household or palace. So he determined he wouldn't do it. I won't go through chapter 1 in detail, because I'm sure you're very familiar with Daniel's proposal and its acceptance and the test that was mounted. Daniel, what a man of faith he was. The very end of the chapter, verse 21, Daniel continued even unto the first year of King Cyrus. Well, we'll see that in the book. That means his standing for the Lord from youth to old age was something like 70 years. He was probably in his mid-80s when his ministry came to an end. He was ministering as a prophet among his people in captivity, no doubt at the time that the captives began to be returned to Judah. In 538, 537 BC, many people think and assume that it was Daniel that drafted the Cyrus decree, setting at liberty the children of Israel. A copy of which, well, an original of which, of the several, is even now in the British Museum. And that's quite likely. Can't be sure of that, can't prove that, but as Daniel was the senior officer of state at that time, it is a very high possibility that he drafted or approved that great statement. And so his ministry was long. But it begins here with the great test as a young man. And we read of him, not by name, in the hall of the heroes of faith, in the letter to the Hebrews and chapter 11, it was certainly true of Daniel among the prophets that he subdued kingdoms in his own way, and he wrought righteousness, and also he obtained promises. Every stand he took was in accordance with the promise of God, and he knew he certainly was one who stopped the mouths of lions. So Daniel is one of those, though not named, who's included in the prophets in the Hall of Fame in Hebrews chapter 11. So we're looking at this first chapter. And let me just call attention to one or two things as we move swiftly on. Verse 9. Now God had brought Daniel into favour and tender love with the prince of the eunuchs. That's his character showing through. No question about that. And in verse 12. Prove thy servants, I beseech thee, 10 days. So the man is going to be persuaded, and there's going to be evidence given by the Lord. And Daniel is given to know that. And in verse 15, at the end of 10 days, their countenances appeared fairer and fatter in flesh than all the children that did eat the portion of the king's meat. And I think that you come down to verse 18 of the chapter, and the end of the verse, these young men are brought before Nebuchadnezzar. And the king, Nebuchadnezzar, was a highly intelligent man, a powerful man, not just one of these monarchs or emperors who succeeded a father but was not worthy of him and had no brains and only brute force. There's no question that Nebuchadnezzar was a very vicious man and a violent man, but he was also an extremely clever man, and he knows how to examine these young people destined for high office himself, and he subjects them to tests. We've no idea what they were. But the result was that they were miles ahead of their compatriots there in verse 20. And so Daniel was established by this early test. The tests of young believers. You come to faith. There are tests of faith and tests of character for Christians throughout life. But among the most important are the earliest ones, the first tests. We're now children of God. We've found the Lord. We have new hearts. Will we give up the world? That's the first test. Will we surrender worldly things? Will we set aside, as we ought to do, those things that we're accustomed to, that we've always enjoyed, that are distinctly worldly, and have come about and have been framed and designed by the world, distinctively with its anti-Christian values and its anti-moral, anti-Christian propaganda, its distinctive music and culture? Will we surrender it? Now, Daniel, in his test, had a much harder test than we shall probably ever have, because had he not taken his stand, well, he would have been sucked into that system and useless to the Lord. But where do we stand in the early tests of our faith and our separating ourselves? And Daniel here, it is implied in the narrative that it was he that inspired the other three young Judean men. They took a stand with him, but he's mentioned first. He initiates it. So his stand inspired others. He's an example from the very beginning. And he was given, in regard to this, his spiritual power and his usefulness. The early stand counts. From time to time, we encounter young people and they profess to be the Lord's and they take no stand. I think, and I don't think I'm looking at things through rose-tinted spectacles, I think in our experience they're a minority, the few, who profess the Lord and take no stand or a poor stand. Sometimes, now and then, they are the most vocal of people. They will tell you what they think they believe and they understand, and they romp ahead in doctrinal accomplishment. But in behavior and in moral things and in separating themselves from the world, they fail all the tests. That's a tragedy. So here we're looking at an example of one who stood for the Lord, not only in his beliefs, but in his behaviour, in his personal piety, in the example he set. Now in the second chapter, you know, what I'm going to try to achieve tonight, I don't know whether we can, is an overview of the whole book. Because we're not specifically embarking upon a series of studies in Daniel, but just an overview to appreciate these things. Chapter 2, in the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadnezzar dreamed dreams. Well, he was a very deeply disturbed emperor. He had had a dream which alarmed and terrified him, and he had to know the meaning of. And he commanded, as you would expect him to do in verse 2, that all his magicians, astrologers, sorcerers, and the Chaldean experts came to interpret the dream. But he doesn't seem to trust them. And so in verse 3, the king said unto them, I've dreamed a dream, my spirit was troubled to know the dream. And they ask him to rehearse the dream before them. And he says in verse 5, the thing is gone from me. I wonder if it had. Maybe it had gone from him. He was frightened by it, but it had gone. But was this his mistrust of his wise men, his astrologers? He asks them, strangely, to tell him what his dream was first. He's a cunning and a highly intelligent man. Is he trying them out? And they protest about this. This is unheard of. Nobody's ever done this. And he threatens them with death. And they protest at that, but of course they cannot tell him what his dream was. And therefore, what happens is that the king becomes very angry, in verse 12, very furious, and commanded to destroy all the wise men of Babylon, and that would include all the trainees from Judah, Daniel and others with him. And so Daniel answered with counsel and wisdom, verse 14, to Arioch, the captain of the king's guard, which was gone forth to slay the wise men of Babylon. And he appeals. And David went in, verse 16, and desired of the king, wasn't seeing the king yet, send a message to the king that he would give him time and he would show the king the interpretation. Well, whatever induced him to do that? It was faith, don't you see? Daniel knew, because the prophets had said so, that Judah would be preserved, and young men were in the key and leading positions, and he felt sure that the promise of God, that the nation would be preserved because one day Christ was coming, that meant that he and his fellows could not possibly be destroyed so early. They were destined to play a part in this. And he believed that these prophecies surely included him. He was perhaps especially inspired by God to know he was to be a prophet after all, that this was the case. But his first action in verse 17 is to go to his three fellows and to begin to pray, verse 18, to desire mercies of the God of heaven concerning this secret, that Daniel and his fellows should not perish with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. Verse 19, then was the secret revealed unto Daniel in a night vision, and his reaction is wonderful. Then Daniel blessed the God of heaven. Daniel answered, and there's this very beautiful prayer, blessed be the name of God for ever and ever. He acknowledges the eternal God, his mighty attributes, wisdom and power. And verse 21, and he changeth the times and the seasons. He removeth kings and setteth up kings. The children of Israel are in God's hands. One day this king and his successors will be removed. He giveth wisdom unto the wise, the great sovereignty of God here, and knowledge to them that know understanding. He revealeth the deep and secret things. He knoweth what is in the darkness, and the light dwelleth with him. The language is beautiful, as well as the sentiments. Verse 23, I thank thee and praise thee, O thou God of my fathers, who hast given me wisdom and might, and hast made known unto me now what we desired of thee. All the glory and the credit is to God. And so the reaction of this young man, nothing goes to his head. He remains perfectly steady. If he's given a great insight and a position, the glory goes at once to the Lord. Therefore Daniel went in unto Arioch and eventually before the king. And you know the outcome without going into the details. But if I read out to you verse 30, Daniel says, but as for me, this secret is not revealed to me for any wisdom that I have more than any living, but for their sakes that shall make known the interpretation to the king. You see the meaning? This has been given to me for the sakes of the Judean boys and the children of Israel. It's for the nation's sake and the Lord's program. He's brought this to pass, and we are going to be preserved because it's all part of the great work of God one day to preserve the nation and bring Messiah into the world. And so the dream is described. Now we'll touch on it very briefly because it's so precious and so important. Verse 31 of chapter 2, a great image. The image's head, verse 32, was of fine gold, his breast and his arms of silver. And the explanation, there's the vision which is described, belly and thighs of brass, legs of iron, feet part of iron and clay, verse 33, and then a stone, verse 34, cut out without hands, which smote the image upon his feet that were of iron and clay, and brake them to pieces. And the explanation which Daniel gives is down there in verse 38. Wheresoever the children of men dwell, the beasts of the field and the fowls of the heaven, hath he given into thine hand, and hath made thee ruler over them all. Thou art this head of gold. Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonian Empire is the head of gold of the image that was to be shattered by the stone. And after him there would be another kingdom, inferior, verse 39, the silver chest and arms part of the image. And that second kingdom, well, this would turn out to be a prediction of the Medo-Persian Empire that would topple the Babylonian Empire. And then another third kingdom, this is verse 39, of brass. So the brass stomach and thighs, and that would be represented by Greece, that would succeed the Median Persian kingdom, which shall bear rule over all the earth. And verse 40, the fourth kingdom, the iron part of the image, the fourth kingdom shall be strong as iron. This is going to be even more strongly expressed in a later vision. This will be Rome, of course, the Roman Empire. For as much as iron breaketh in pieces and subdueth all things, and the crushing power of the Roman Empire is described in this prophecy. And as iron that breaketh all these shall it break in pieces and bruise. And then there's an explanation of the way in which the Roman kingdom would break up in verse 41. But there will be from it many other smaller kingdoms going through the history of the world. And then in verse 44, the stone that shatters Rome and the Iron Empire. Verse 44, in the days of these kings shall the God of heaven set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed. Christ will come, and the kingdom shall not be left to other people, but it shall break in pieces, that is Rome, and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. So after Babylon, and then the Medo-Persian Empire, then the Empire of Greece, and the Empire of Rome, there'll be no more dominant world empires like those four, because the kingdom of God will come in, and that will be throughout the world. It will be represented in every land and nation, and of course it will grow to be the greatest empire ever, because it will go on down the centuries of time. And Christian people, though a minority in every nation, when all added together from every land and every age, will be a far greater empire, as it were, under Christ, than all those others. And that's explained in verse 45. Well, that's the amazing first prophecy of Daniel. The prophecy of the world empires and the coming of the kingdom of Christ. And that is astonishing. Why should one so young be given such a far-reaching and extensive prophecy? How could it be? Well, secrets are revealed to the faithful. There is no new revelation since the completion of the New Testament, but understanding of the things that God has revealed and the precious things of the Scripture comes most of all to Christian people who are faithful. Not necessarily the brainiest, but the most faithful comes understanding of these amazing truths. Then the king, verse 46, Nebuchadnezzar fell upon his face and worshipped Daniel. Of course, he didn't know any better. He commanded that they should offer an oblation and sweet odours unto him, which would have been acutely embarrassing to Daniel. But he acknowledged his God. And don't you see, it was led to verse 48, where Daniel was made a great man with many gifts and made a high ruler over the whole province of Babylon and chief of the governors. And then his three friends also given office. So because of his faithfulness and God's use of him and his prophecy and the amazing effect this had on Nebuchadnezzar, Daniel, more swiftly than Joseph ever was, is elevated to a high office of state, and the Israelites, the captives, will be secure in such a reign. They will still be captives, but life will be much kinder to them, and they will still be allowed to have their priests and their prophets among them, even in captivity, and they will not be annihilated. There will be no genocide, no fury unleashed upon them, because the chief officers of state in that Babylonian empire are now Judean young men. And of course it all pivots round the faithfulness of four of them. When we look on to chapter 3, Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold. And this would affect directly not Daniel, but his three fellows. It was 90 feet high, 9 feet across. It was for to be worshipped. Nebuchadnezzar had grown so great in his estimation with his power and his glory that he wished to be worshipped as a god. And it led, as you know, to the three friends being cast into the midst of a burning fiery furnace because they would not so worship. They believed the promise of Exodus, promise of God with his people, that in all their trials I will be with thee. They were very modest when they were challenged by Nebuchadnezzar, because don't forget they were high officers. Verse 14 of the chapter, Nebuchadnezzar spake and said unto the young men, three of them charged with failing to worship him, is it true, O Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, do not ye serve my gods, nor worship the golden image which I have set up? If it true, and he gives them a last chance, as it were. But in verse 16, what a superb answer they give. They said to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we are not careful, meaning we are hesitant to answer thee in this matter. If it be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us, out of thine hand, O king. They weren't sure. They didn't know for certain. They said to the king, in effect, if we lose our lives, we lose our lives. If God chooses to save us, we believe he can. But if not, be it known unto thee, O king, that we will not serve thy gods, nor worship the golden image which thou hast set up, the great challenge and faithfulness. And of course you know the account, you know how they were preserved, you know how a fourth figure was seen with them, no doubt a theophany, Jesus Christ the Lord, appearing to them as their comforter and their companion. And the result of this is, because their stand has a very practical result, that in verse 28, Nebuchadnezzar is overwhelmed. He is so impressed by them, and he passes decrees which protect them and all fellow Judeans. Now, time had passed. Perhaps hostility was being shown in Babylon against the Jews and in the empire, but the result of their stand is a redoubled protection of Israelites in captivity in that land, and the three are mightily promoted. Chapter 4. Well, what an amazing chapter this is. It is Nebuchadnezzar's open letter to the nations. Now, most people traditionally, Bible believers, have felt that Nebuchadnezzar was surely, in due course, converted to true faith. Now, some doubt that, and we cannot be certain, but the narrative in the book of Daniel is highly supportive in many ways of the conversion of Nebuchadnezzar. And among the evidence is this remarkable open letter. What a fool Nebuchadnezzar risks making of himself writing to the nations about this experience which was his. But he does so. In fact, once again, did Daniel, who was effectively his prime minister and head of state for administrative purposes, did he draft this letter for Nebuchadnezzar at his instruction? Who knows? Chapter 4, Nebuchadnezzar the king, unto all people, nations and languages. You would expect him to defend his gods to the hilt. You would expect him to stand on that. But no, verse 2, I thought it good to show thee the signs and wonders that the high God hath wrought toward me, a singular God from a polytheist. How great are his signs, and how mighty are his wonders. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and his dominion from generation to generation. I, Nebuchadnezzar, was at rest in mine house. He was complacent. He was self-satisfied. He was flourishing in his palace. He was admiring himself and his achievements. And he saw a dream which made him afraid, verse 5, and the thoughts upon his bed troubled him, and the vision. Well, he was far away from the Lord, as he tells us at the beginning of this testimony, in verse 6, because he calls in those discredited Chaldean experts and magicians and astrologers and soothsayers again. And they come in verse 7, and they can't make known unto him the interpretation of his dream. And verse 8, but at the last, he left Daniel to be called last. Presumably because he knew he was in a state of rebellion against Daniel's God. And so he was the last. He calls him with great reluctance. He's that far away from any true belief. He came in before me, whose name was Belteshazzar, according to the name of my God. Sounds as though Daniel was able to revert to his own name for quite some time. He was told the dream, and he interpreted the dream. You know it, again, I'm sure. There's a great tree that grows, and it's very beautiful, and it's immensely high and fruitful. The leaves thereof were fair, the fruit thereof much. And then a watcher comes down, verse 13, and an holy one down from heaven, an angel. And he says, hew down the tree, cut off his branches, strip it, shake off everything, and let the beasts get away from under it. Just leave a stump. but even put a band of iron and brass on that stump. In the tender grass of the field, let it be wet with the dew of heaven. And then, because it's quite clear this tree represents a man, verse 16, let his heart be changed from man's, and let a beast's heart be given unto him. And so on. And Nebuchadnezzar, well, obviously, I would think he understands much of the dream. He knows that this is the downfall of a mighty and a great person, and somebody is going to be visited with some form of insanity and is going to be humiliated. The thing that concerns Nebuchadnezzar is this: who will it be? Who does it refer to? Isn't it obvious it refers to he himself? Well, no, he's such a great man in his estimation. He is the foremost emperor. He exceeds the power and glory of any who have preceded him. And is he not, unlike any other emperor, does he not show kindness? Of course he doesn't most of the time. It's Daniel and others who show all the kindness. But does he not allow all his captives to live in reasonable prosperity in his dominions, in his domain? He is so self-righteous, this idolatrous king. He knows what the dream means, but he doesn't think it applies to him. He's only slightly afraid of that. That's the problem he has. Who is this? Not what is this? Then, verse 19, Daniel, Belteshazzar, he was astonished for 1 hour. He's deeply concerned about this. His thoughts troubled him. He knew what it was. He was deeply troubled, probably most of all, about his role in all this. And then, while Nebuchadnezzar consoles him, he knows he's got to confront the king with the truth. What will be the result of this? Will he be the object of the king's fury? This is one of the, let's call it, classic confrontations of Scripture. Oh, the old writers all noticed this. This is like Moses, with enormous courage, confronting Pharaoh and telling him the truth. Like Elijah confronting Ahab. Or even, and we say it reverently, like Christ confronting Pontius Pilate. And then later on, Paul confronting King Agrippa. This is one of the great confrontations of Scripture, where a child of God standing in the presence of one who appears to have complete power over him is going to stand up to him and tell him the truth. And so Daniel does, and he describes the tree, verses 20 and 21, and then verse 22, it is thou, O king, that art grown and become strong. And then he's going to tell him, it's his pride. It's his pride, his arrogance. And verse 24, this is the interpretation, O king, and this is the decree of the Most High God, which has come upon my lord the king. You will be driven from men, and you'll have to live like a beast of the field, and eat grass, and you'll lose your reason and your command of everything. And so he describes it. And then he pleads with the king. He preaches to him. Verse 27, wherefore, O king, let my counsel be acceptable unto thee, and break off thy sins by righteousness. He must confront the emperor of all the world, and thine iniquities by showing mercy to the poor, if it may be a lengthening of thy tranquility. But the king is too proud to repent. And a year later, verse 29, he's still strutting about in his palace, and he's praising himself, verse 30, is not this great Babylon that I have built for the house of the kingdom by the might of my power, and for the honour of my majesty? And then the judgment fell, and he was humbled, humiliated, and judged. And then verse 36, the time came when his reason returned unto him. Well, read from verse 34. At the end of the days, I, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted up mine eyes unto heaven, and mine understanding returned unto me, and I praised the Most High, and this is to all the nations of the world, and I praised and honoured him that liveth for ever, whose dominion is an everlasting dominion. And so on, and the final verse of the chapter seemed to be such a profession of faith that it's rather difficult to think that sometime at the end of his life this did not literally occur to Nebuchadnezzar. You know about chapter 5 and Belshazzar and the end of the Babylonian Empire and how he was brought to this, all about his last day. I won't go into that because in this lightning kind of review of everything, I'd just like to say a word or two about the closing visions. We can't do everything, but just a tiny bit. Chapter 7. In the first year of Belshazzar, the empire has fallen. Now there's a great test for Daniel in chapter 6. You know about that, with the lion's den and his deliverance from that. And so that establishes his office in the kingdom once again, though the kingdom has changed. Very unusual for a person to be senior officer of state and prime minister in the reign of one empire and then be retained for the service of the ruler who follows him. But that great honour and privilege and power fell to Daniel. But verse 7 goes back to before the fall of the Babylonian Empire. And the vision that Daniel had at that time. And verse 2, I saw in my vision by night, behold, the four winds of the heaven strove upon the great sea. And four great beasts, were they going to be just like the others? And they're going to stand for the same things. The first beast, verse 4, was like a lion, just the same as the other first beast. It's a picture of Babylon. Had eagle's wings, the Babylonian Empire. I beheld till the wings thereof were plucked, and it was lifted up from the earth. And a man's heart was given to it. Some people think that may be a reference to the conversion of Nebuchadnezzar, just before, towards the end of that whole Babylonian period. But then verse 5, behold another beast, a second, one like to a bear. And the second beast, just as before, represents, no doubt, the next empire, which was the Median-Persian Empire, the Medes and the Persians. And it raised up itself on one side, and so on. And verse 6, after this I beheld, and lo, another, like a leopard, which had upon the back of it four wings of a fowl. The beast also had four heads, the empire of Greece, the Greeks, and dominion was given unto it. And after this, we're coming to the Romans, verse 7. A fourth beast, dreadful, terrible, strong, exceedingly, great iron teeth, iron like the previous prophecy. It devoured and brake in pieces and stamped the residue with the feet of it. And it was diverse from all the beasts that were before it. And it had 10 horns. And when it breaks up eventually, this longing for empire will continue in the world, but it will always be fragmented and never as powerful as the ancient world empires. I considered the horns, verse 8, and behold, there came up among them another little horn, before whom there were three. Well, without going too much into the details, the little horn had eyes like the eyes of man and a mouth speaking great things, a pompous, bombastic, unpleasant horn with a message and much to say. We'll see later on what that message was. But in the meantime, there's a great encouragement in this vision. Verse 9, I beheld till the thrones were cast down, and the Ancient of Days till did sit. This is what you call today a fast forward to the last day of the world. Don't worry about these empires. They're all going to pass, and their successors. because the Ancient of Days, God himself, whose garment was white as snow and the hair of his head like the pure wool. Well, the great description of God's power and justice. And verse 10, a fiery stream issued. Thousands ministered unto him. Angels and ransomed saints, 10,000 times 10,000, stood before him. Book of Revelation tells us that those are the angels. The judgment was set up and the books were open. And then the beast was slain, his body destroyed. And all the other beasts, their dominion was at an end. But now we go back again a little bit. Verse 13, I saw in the night visions, and behold, one like the Son of Man came with the clouds of heaven and came to the Ancient of Days, and they brought him near before him. And there was given him dominion and glory and a kingdom, all people, nations and languages. What amazing things Daniel saw. There were going to be these four world empires. They will succeed one another. But that won't actually be the end. Then will come the kingdom of Christ, the gospel age. And at the end of the gospel age, Christ will come on the clouds and there'll be the last day of judgment. But the people who will be gathered in will be people from all lands and nations, because during that gospel age, the word will go right around the world. So there's the scheme that is given of end times and all of time. Daniel was grieved when he heard these things because of the depth and the might of it all. And he was shown the interpretation, verse 16, and that proceeds. But look at the details that were given. We must close with this because we're over time. There's the fourth beast in verse 19. We're back to discussing that. The ten horns, verse 20. There'll be lots of minor empires after the fall of Rome. But there's then the horn that had eyes, halfway through verse 20. And a mouth that spake very great things, whose look was more stout or proud than his fellows. And I beheld, and that same horn made war with the saints and prevailed against them. But that horn was to be judged. And just to conclude, because we haven't time, that's nothing other than a description, the little horn, of the rising Antichrist. Throughout the Gospel Age, but particularly at the end of the Gospel Age. The details are expounded more fully in the book of Revelation. And there is Antichrist against God, against the saints, and, as we read in this chapter, in one of these verses, against God's law and moral values. We see the Antichrist becoming now more fully revealed in our age, not only voices raised against God and against the people of God, the church, but voices raised against the very morality of God, the standards of God, and the values, the ancient values and moral standards being attacked and torn down and turned round so that evil becomes good and good becomes evil. And that is the prediction and the prophecy of Daniel. And even just look at verse 25. He shall speak great words against the Most High. Here's the summary. Shall wear out the saints of the Most High and think to change times and laws, and they shall be given into his hand until, and look at this remarkable phrase, a time and times and the dividing of time. A time and times and half a time. And Daniel will be given that again in a later vision in this book that we will not proceed to. What are a time and times and half a time? Well, it's the code symbol of Daniel, employed also in the book of Revelation. A year and 2 years and half a year, and time, and times, and the dividing of time, or half a time. The same term is expressed in days, both in the book of Daniel and in the book of Revelation. Also in the book of Revelation, it is clearly stated as 3.5 years. What does it mean? It is the code symbol for the gospel age. It is the same code symbol as the 1,000 years, the so-called millennium of Revelation 20. It is the code symbol in the book of Daniel and the book of Revelation for the period of time between the first and the second comings of Christ, the age of the gospel. And that's what's predicted here in such amazing language. Empires will fall, lesser empires will go on, carrying on the spirit of the first, the great world empires, but the kingdom of Christ will come in, and the gospel would be preached, and people of all languages and nations and ages will be saved, and there'll be this set time, the code symbol, 3.5 years, the equivalent in days and in time, times, half a time, and then Christ comes on the clouds. It's all there, and it's repeated even more succinctly just a little later on. What a privileged person Daniel was. What a mighty person. Multiple roles. A senior head of state for the preservation of God's people and God's promises, so that the nation would one day return and Messiah would come and the promises would be fulfilled. And yet, one of the greatest of all prophets. We love Isaiah. We love the details of Calvary that he presents, the details of the New Testament church. But Daniel is unique in telling us about the empires and the ages and the day of judgment in the way that he does. And may I suggest to you, it all pivots round the story, the biography of Daniel, that earliest test, that test of faith. Did he stand? Would he defy the world, avoid worldliness, stand clearly for the Lord and for the principles that God had taught him? And he did, and that was the key to it all. Let's close this evening singing the hymn 462.